emotional support to a patient and their family in the final stages of a disease. Most of our patients are cancer patients, but we do have a few that are not patients dying of heart disease or lung disease, or we even had a baby die of a rare disease. So it isn't, I would say over 95% of our patients are cancer patients. We do not talk about length of life for a patient.
Problems with it.
My boss always says the terminal is at the airport. We don't talk about terminal. But we talk about helping them to live the best they can for whatever time they have. I would say most patients are in our program on an average of 2 to 3 months. The criteria, some of the criteria we use, first of all, we judge the patient and the family as one unit of care. We would not do everything that we can to support the patient at the expense of letting the family go down the tubes from physical and emotional exhaustion. So if it's not going, so we keep very close track of the patient and the family as we go through the process. We do not usually get involved with the patient unless there is a plan to go home, because as I mentioned, we are home-based, and I will explain that further. If it looks like a patient cannot go home at all, then usually the social worker works with the family, and they're placed in some kind of a care center. As some of you may be aware of, insurance regulations now, we can't keep patients in the hospital indefinitely, even if they are dying. They have to have some specific symptoms like pneumonia or an infection or pain that's out of control. But if they're reasonably stable, even if they are dying, they can't stay in the hospital. The insurance will not cover that. So our social worker will work with the family and the patient and find alternative care. We do, one of our goals is to keep the patient independent as long as possible. One of the requirements we have is that the patient does need to have a primary caregiver at home. Now, if they have a spouse that's not working, or a large family where they take turns, you know, this usually works out well. It does become a problem sometime when a spouse does have to work during the day. But it's possible that we can put together a program using volunteers, and if the patient has some friends or family that can come and fill in the hours, then that can work out all right. It doesn't have to be the same person for 24 hours. But we feel if a patient is sick enough to be in hospice, they do need to have somebody with them at all times at home. And we don't get involved with a patient until we have the doctor's order from their primary physician. We are an interdisciplinary team. We have a medical director who is an oncologist. In the coordinating office at the hospital, there is the coordinator who happens to be the chaplain, a chaplain, and then there's another nurse that works with me, and we basically share one position. The rest of the team, it would include a social worker, a dietitian, a pharmacist, a visiting nurse that will see the patient at home, and of course we work closely with the patient's own primary physicians. We don't give orders without talking to their primary physician. So that's basically who is on the team. The team does meet once a week, and we discuss all of the patients, and we discuss their problems, we try to troubleshoot, and basically it helps to have five minds working together than one. So I'll kind of go through what benefits we can offer to the patient. First of all, there is a nurse on call 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. So if any question arises at home, from the family or the patient, there's always somebody they can call to get an answer to that question. It may simply be answering the question, or the nurse may say, I better call the doctor about this, or she may say, or he, we do have one male nurse, may say, I'm going to have to make a visit and see what's going on. Or she may say, this patient should get to the hospital right away, and she would notify the doctor and call the ambulance for them. Then each patient is assigned a visiting nurse, and we work very closely with, keep in close contact with the visiting nurse to keep track of what's happening with the patient. The nurse would go out to see the patient once or twice a week, maybe three times a week if the patient was very unstable. Now, these nursing visits are covered by their insurance. And by to backtrack, there is no cost for the hospice team per se. The hospital pays our salaries, that of the coordinator and the patient care coordinators. So, and there's no cost so far to what I've, mentioned. The visiting nurse then sees the patients once or twice or three times a week, depending on if they're stable. If they're very stable, then they can't go as often. If they're less stable, then they can go more often. When the nurse goes out, she stays about an hour. She cannot stay in the home to take care of the patient, but she does a physical assessment just to see what the symptoms are. And a primary thing in hospice is working towards symptom control. Now, pain control is one of the biggest things we deal with. I do have to say, though, that at least 20% of our patients don't have pain. And that's one of the fears of people that get cancer, that they will have a lot of pain. Our philosophy behind pain control is that we give whatever amount of medication is necessary to control the pain. And we give doses far exceeding an average dose of pain medication, for instance, if you would have surgery. I would say, you know, a big dose then would maybe be 15 milligrams of morphine every 4 hours, 3 or 4 hours. That's what you get if you have an operation. With hospice patients, when pain is a big problem, I've seen it get as high as 200 milligrams every 4 hours. So many patients fear that they will die in pain, and we want to try to allay their fears that they don't have to die in pain, that we will give them the amount of medication necessary to control the pain. Addiction is not something to worry about. For number one, if you've got the pain, then narcotics are not addicting if there is a reason to require them. And second of all, it's kind of a moot point anyway, because the patient has a limited amount of time. But if a patient takes the pain medication every 4 hours, even if they're at a high dosage, they may get very sleepy initially, but after about 48 hours, they will become more alert, and patients can function quite well with high doses of pain medication after their body becomes accustomed to it. So we really stress giving it, taking it every 4 hours to keep the level of the blood level up. And we usually give that orally. It comes in long-acting tablets and short-acting and concentrated liquid. And it also comes in suppositories. And we also do give it intravenously at home, but we don't give shots at home. I can recall a relative of mine having to get shots at home for pain. That's a very invasive procedure and often causes more discomfort. And we simply don't use those at home. There are better ways to control it. So we look at any symptom the patient might have. If nausea is a symptom, then we find whatever medication might be helpful to control nausea. Constipation can be a big problem because narcotics are very constipating. So that's something that we would always look at and increase laxatives when we increase the pain medication. The nurse is always assessing their diet. And just a few things about diet for a patient in the end stages of life. it's a source of real anxiety for the relatives if the patient doesn't eat. And if they prod the patient too much, then it doesn't really help because the patient wants to eat themselves, but they just can't. And it hurts when for the relative to see the patient not eating because they know this what will eventually happen. But we just encourage the relatives to try to relax about it as much as possible, realizing that it is a very difficult thing to do because all of our best moments in life usually are centered around eating and family celebrations and that sort of thing. So we encourage the patient to eat whatever they can, when they can, like frequent small feedings. We recommend supplements if they can't eat solid foods, such as Carnation Instant Breakfast. And there are some other dietary supplements which work very well. Eating in small portions. And one big thing is relatives want to give them a good, well-balanced diet. And it comes to a point where you really have to go for the calories and not the diet, because people need calories to maintain their muscle mass. And if they're going to get it through candy, and if that's what the patient craves, then they should have candy. It will at least retain the muscle mass so they don't deteriorate as quickly. So it can be a very emotional subject, and we just encourage the patient to eat whatever they can, when they can, in whatever amount they can. And beyond that, we can't go any further. So the nurse is there to assist with all those things, and the dietitian can be consulted if there are some special problems. The nurse is also in the home as a teacher, and she teaches the patient and the family what they need to know about the disease, about their medications, about their care. And I was a visiting nurse before I did this job, so I'm real familiar with that end of it. And the nurse is there as a support person for the patient and the family. And it was amazing. I found if you take it a day at a time, the family members can do a lot more than they think they can do, because I had, I remember one daughter in particular who didn't think she could keep her mom home until death. She would have liked to, but she really didn't think she could. But we took it a day at a time and just met the problems as they came, and she handled it very beautifully, and as many families do, and was very rewarded. That felt very good that she was able to keep her mom at home. Another job of the visiting nurse is to supervise a home health aide who can come in and give the patient a bath once or twice a week, and this is also usually covered by the insurance policy. There again, she only stays for about 30 minutes, and we encourage, again, the aide would encourage the patient to be able to do whatever they can do. If they could get into the shower, she would assist the patient with the shower. But if they couldn't get out of bed, she would give a bed bath. So we do encourage a patient to stay as active as long as they possibly can. We offer the patient any equipment they might need in the home in order to make them more comfortable, make them more independent, or make their care a little easier for the family. This is usually covered by the insurance company, and whatever isn't covered by insurance is picked up by the American Cancer Society. This would include an adjustable bed with side rails that can be used if necessary. And often a patient can get out of bed more easily if they can hold on to side rails. A wheelchair, which sometimes sound, I don't want a wheelchair, I'm not that sick. But sometimes a wheelchair can take a patient places that they could not otherwise go, such as walking around the block or even getting to a shopping center or that sort of thing. We recommend egg carton mattresses for all of our patients, which now you see them advertised at Target or a lot of Sears, Penney's, but they're foam mattresses about 3 inches thick. They're in the shape of an egg carton. And they reduce the pressure to a patient's bony prominences, to their coccyx, their tailbone, which it tends to break down easily, and they're just more comfortable. Then we have volunteers, which that's part of my job, is to work with our volunteers, and that's one of my favorite things. Volunteers are really a hallmark of hospice. Many programs were started strictly with volunteers, and many programs still operate mostly with volunteers and then a contract with the county visiting nurses to do their nursing visits. But the volunteers are there primarily to give respite care to the family. So they would go in and stay with the patient for 4 hours at a time, 1 to 3 times a week maybe, to stay with the patient, do whatever is needed for the patient so the family can get away. And we've had any number of cases where I know a family could not have lasted at home without the volunteers, because it's just crucial to get away. 24-hour responsibility for caring for somebody is a lot, and it is very tiring. And our volunteers are just wonderful people who just seem to know the right thing to do when they get to a patient's home. They do have at least 20 hours of training initially, and then we meet with them every 2 weeks and have kind of a support group and teach them what they need to know about the different patients. And we send them to continuing education kind of seminars whenever they're available. And they will go into the home and they kind of sense what the patient needs. If the patient doesn't want to talk, that's fine. They'll sit quietly in the corner. If they want to talk, they're all too happy to. And so they'll attend to whatever needs they have while they're there. So I can really say a hospice program cannot function without volunteers. We hope to have volunteers doing more things. Our program is going to be expanding, and we're going to need more volunteers in the office, and possibly doing things, if we can get nursing volunteers, maybe have volunteers who will provide care for extended periods of time in the home. So everything I've mentioned to this point is really at no cost to the patient or the family. Now, if the patient does need more help in the home and it is not available through relatives or neighbors or volunteers, they may hire care. And insurance policies usually do not cover what we call extended hours of care, where a nursing assistant can go in there for 8 hours at a time. Actually, there are some policies which will say you can have a nurse, an RN, in the home if necessary. But unless the patient has needs that require the skills of an RN, the insurance company won't pay for it. And that would mean if they had an intravenous infusion or if they had some tubes or complicated dressings that needed changing by a nurse, then that's the only time an insurance company will pay for an RN. We find that most of our patients can get by with the care of a home health aide. And the cost is about $11.50 an hour. That sounds like a lot of money, but sometimes if a family would hire a nursing assistant to stay with the patient during the night so they can get a good night's sleep once or twice a week, that's just enough to keep them going so they can keep their loved one at home. If it comes to the point where the family is no longer comfortable having the patient at home, or the patient is no longer comfortable, or their care becomes too complicated, they could either come back to the hospital if they have an acute need, which requires some real specific medical attention, or our social worker would get involved and help find some placement in an appropriate care facility. We do have one facility in St. Paul, which is called Our Lady of Good Counsel, which is a home that's run by some Dominican sisters, and it's free for a person that's dying of cancer. There are only 7 of these in the country. The other 6 are more on the East Coast, so we're very fortunate. It's just a wonderful place where the care is given mostly by nuns, but you don't have to be a Catholic to go there. And it's just wonderful, loving care. They only take the amount of patients that they know they can, that they have enough staff to care for. So once in a while, we can get a patient in there, which is to their benefit. We also have a lawyer that works with us, and we just recommend in general that being good stewards of property, to have legal affairs in order. We don't bring it up as something to remind them that while they're dying, you better get your legal affairs in order, but it's the kind of thing that you and I should all have in order anyway. Life sometimes tends to be very short and unpredictable. So we have a lawyer that will give free advice over the phone and gives, if he has to do some paperwork, he does that at a very reduced cost. And as I mentioned before, we have our chaplain is also our coordinator, and we offer spiritual support whenever it is needed. It's not something we force onto a patient. We just let them know that it is available. We end up doing a lot of counseling with patients and families, and I feel a lot of that is spiritual support, but you know, we don't necessarily always talk specifically. We don't usually talk specifically unless they ask. Another thing we found is we like to refer patients to their local clergy too, because then they've got a support system. The family has a support system in their local clergy after the patient dies. Because sometimes we do get patients that are not affiliated with the church, and then they'll ask our chaplain to do the funeral, and not only he just is not able to do that. He would be doing funerals all the time. But also, it's just good to get them set up with the local parishes so they can follow up for support. Another big thing about the program is that we do register all of our patients with the medical examiner in the county in which they reside. And because if anybody dies at home, it's a law that the medical examiner would have to investigate that case and come out to the house and ask all kinds of questions. If we can register them with the medical examiner in advance, which we do with all of our patients, then if the patient dies at home, all the family needs to do is call the on-call nurse, and she will come to the home, and she only needs to make a call to the medical examiner, and she calls the doctor and the mortician and whatever calls the family would like her to make. And it's just a very quiet time and special time for the family. And I always found it really rewarding because some people think that's really weird, but to go into a home and help a patient and family through that time, I felt was really a privilege. It's such a profound time in the life of a family, and it's very real. Everybody's very sincere. Their emotions are right there, and I just feel it can be a beautiful, gentle experience at home in the midst of the pain. It's a very profound time, and I felt it was really an honor to be a part of that. Now, there's another protection we can offer a patient at home, and they can sign a legal form which says they do not want to be resuscitated. They do not want to have external cardiac massage, or they do not want to be intubated and put on a respirator. Now, people often think that if they sign the living will, then that takes care of these wishes, but it's important to know if in your state a living will is legal. In Minnesota, it is not. Our legislature has been trying to get something passed, but it is not legal at this point. So if somebody would call the paramedics, even if it wasn't the patient's wishes, if somebody would panic and call the paramedics, they by law would have to begin resuscitation. Or the other thing that sometimes happens, if the family needs to call the paramedics to give a patient oxygen, or if a patient would fall and break a bone and need to be hospitalized, or if they would need to be hospitalized for any reason. Occasionally, when the patient is nearing death, the family decides that they really don't want the patient at home to die. So we'll have to transport them to the hospital. And unless they have this form and they would arrest on the way to the hospital, they would have to be resuscitated by law. So it's real important to sign this form. But it does, the form does say that they are eligible for any treatment up until the point of their heart stopping to beat or stop breathing. So it doesn't mean that they're giving up any form of treatment. And the form also says that this can be revoked at any time. They can tear it up. It's strictly for their protection at their request. It's not something we require at this point. Then after the patient has died, we do follow them for 1 year. And we contact them at 3 months, 6 months, and 1 year. We do also contact them initially and offer them to come to what we call Time to Mourn, which is a grief group that meets every Monday continuously. It kind of is in 8-week schedules, but families can come in or out at any time they want. There's no pressure on them to talk, or they can just be who they need to be at those sessions. We normally kind of recommend that families come, you know, after a few months, because they're usually in a state of shock for a while, and it's usually more helpful if they come a little bit later. But they are certainly welcome in the first week or two if they would like. And sometimes families don't really feel the need for it till a year or two later. They find they're dealing with issues later on, and everybody grieves very differently, and so we don't say, we don't have any schedule that we think a person should be grieving by. Everybody is very different. That's one thing that's come out very clearly to me. So they're welcome to come to grief group at any point. We do also have support groups for our patients and families. They meet separately. Our patients meet on every Tuesday morning. Our families meet on Wednesdays. They come and go as they need. Those groups have been very helpful for the patients and the families. Any questions? That's basically, yes.
Do you ever have single people who are able to take advantage of a hospice program? They have no family.
If they have no family.
You said in the beginning you have to have a
family. We do. It's tough. It is tough to do if they have no family. If they have some funds and can hire some help, it's possible. And we have had situations like that. And you can hire a live-in nursing assistant at quite a bit cheaper, for about $140 a day. But if a patient becomes very ill and needs attention 24 hours a day, then the live-in can't be there, because the live-in has to be able to sleep at night. At this point, we can't really provide care for a single person, and I feel really badly about that. That's something we haven't found an answer to, because we really feel if they're sick enough to need hospice, they really need some care.
We have a member of our congregation who has been through 3 surgeries, and the last surgery, the church took on support. I was exhausted in a few months, just when she was on the way to getting well. you know, the meals and the, and the emotional support and all that. And she looks like she's going to have to either just make a decision whether she's going to go through this or not. So I'm just looking at the hospice idea because it's a, it's a, the family at church is very important to her. And,
we had a patient, as it turned out she didn't go home, but her husband worked during the day. She was my age. She was about 10 days older than me. And her husband worked during the day. And we met with about 6 volunteers from their church who really wanted to put together a program. And we were willing to work with the volunteers and teach them everything to lay on all volunteers.
That's what I'm trying to get a feel for. That sounds like a pretty heavy load.
Yeah, it really would be. I could say a little bit more. Now, I don't know what... it would be worth checking into the hospice programs in your area.
We have a hospice program, I know, and I will.
Yeah. I know the other hospital that works in our system does not require a primary caregiver, but when the patient gets to the point where they can't stay alone, then they do have to go to a care facility anyway. I can talk a little bit what our program is changing, and we're going to be applying for hospice Medicare certification, which is a new thing. It's reasonably new in the last 5 years, and a lot of programs in the country are becoming hospice Medicare certified. I believe they do require a primary caregiver, but it is possible that depending on the program in your area, maybe you could work around that. Now, the difference with hospice Medicare certification, it does have more benefits for the patient. What happens is we become the insurer. Medicare is going to pay us a certain amount per day for every patient we have in the hospice program. And then we can spend that money as we see fit. So if a patient, but it goes on the premise that a patient has to be at home, that we have to average out having 80% of our patients at home and 20% in the hospital, because obviously it's going to cost us a lot more to have them in the hospital or a nursing home. But we've heard from most other Medicare certified programs that it usually works out that way. You sort of make money on the patients while they're at home, so that you build up money to spend on patients when they need more care later. So it's possible this person, if it was a Medicare certified program, she might be able to get involved early on and then later be able to benefit from an inpatient program. It would certainly be worth checking into what your hospice program offers.
Thank you.
Have any of you known anybody that's been in a hospice program?
I had some experience with hospice program and am hoping to go back home and be available as a volunteer.
Oh.
I lost my husband last August. At the time that he was admitted to the hospital, when we went in, he was encountering a lot of difficulty. And we went into the oncology department after seeing his doctor, and the nurse took one look at me and she said, "Have you considered hospice?"
Mm-hmm.
And I said, "Well, my doctor had recommended it, but we had discussed it and felt it wasn't needed."
Mm-hmm.
But I said, "I'm reaching a point where I feel it could be a benefit to me." So she said, they have their office in the city in this particular hospital that we were in. So she called and the hospice leader came down and talked to me while my husband was in seeing the radiologist. And I didn't want to force it on him.
Mm-hmm.
But she said, "Well, I would like to talk to him." So I said, "Well, you know, if he if he consents, you know, that will be fine. And so, a very loving woman, and she talked to him, and so he consented to use the services. However, they had to admit him to the hospital, and he was there 8.5 weeks and never did get back home.
Yeah.
But they were wonderful. Mm-hmm. They followed up. She would stop in frequently, and as with her training, I guess, she could really get him to reveal a lot of things that nurses couldn't.
Mm-hmm.
And she continued, as you said, the follow-up in the time after his death,
mm-hmm.
Calling to see if I wanted to come into a group of people who had lost a loved one within the last year. Mm-hmm. And she called me just shortly before I came out here to see how things were going. And I can certainly see the benefit in the program, even though I wasn't able to use it at home.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
The love was tremendous.
Mm-hmm.
And that's so important, I think, to someone when they are dying.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we do often, since we're hospital-based, we do often get involved with patients and families. Mm-hmm. While in the hospital and see them frequently, as you described, but it just turns out that they don't stabilize to a point of being able to go home.
My only experience with it was the family in our congregation. It was so nice to have Virginia home because we could drop in there. You know, just for short periods of time, she was in the neighborhood of the church. And many of us have errands at church and back and forth, and the hospital is quite a distance away. And it made it possible for us to be with her more and to enjoy her. And she had a wonderful sense of humor. It was just sort of nice to stop in and
mm-hmm.
be able to spend some time with her.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and just your presence. You know, people sometimes get a little nervous and don't know what they're going to say. But just
your
presence.
You have to say something sometimes.
No, you don't. Just being there and sort of, we really stress they're a regular person with a disease and to treat them like a regular person and not like somebody with a disease.
Touching, but I think, is important.
Touch, yeah, real important. It can be real lonely. Because people do tend to want to avoid these people because they don't know what to say. But just to treat them as a normal, regular person. I feel badly too because they don't, when they're sick in bed, they don't get so many hugs anymore. And that's just real important. And so I've learned to hug a lot in hospice.
My husband used to say to me, I could use a hug. Mm-hmm. It didn't matter who was there.
That's really nice that
and
he was that open to,
and,
to say that.
So I'd go hug him. Mm-hmm. And if there was a visitor, they'd go hug him.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, that's, like you said, it's, mm-hmm. it is important.
Mm-hmm. I was wondering what else you might use besides drugs. It sounded like a lot of drugs, which I just don't respond well to. And it sounds like the hugging will be part of that. That's, I mean,
you mean for symptom control and stuff?
Yeah.
Well, we've used some relaxation. I haven't had too much experience with that, but that's something which, you know, we'd like to look into more. And massage can be a real good thing too. We have the wife of one of our former patients has become a masseuse, therapeutic kind of, and we'd like to get her involved in our program because that could be a real benefit.
This friend of mine who has had surgeries and chemotherapy before frequently says, Jane, rub my feet. that is something that, that's where she's losing feeling or it hurts or it cramps, mm-hmm. and that I'm reminded of it. Where mm-hmm. she's free enough to ask for it. Mm-hmm. She says, "I'm getting to the place I'm going to ask for anything I need," and she does.
Yeah.
And that's helpful to me when she will. But she asks for massages and rubs just lots mm-hmm. of times.
And that'll give you enough touch too, you know. And sometimes a good massage will feel like it was a prolonged hug or something. Mm-hmm. It's like
that would be really helpful. Yeah, if it does sound, you know, like you hate to use all these drugs, but it's just, I don't know any way around it when they, you know, get into the hard pain. We start out with basically our most common drugs are like anti-inflammatories like Motrin or Tylenol, and then move up to codeine in small doses and gradually increase that, and then morphine, because codeine and morphine are more like, most like the body's own pain medication, and they work the best. So most of our patients, if they need pain medication at all, they use those.
Well, with the new machines too, they can only get a certain amount of dosage.
Yeah, if they're intravenous, if they get intravenous morphine, there's a cassette that administers the drug at a regular interval, and they're set so you can't get more than is ordered.
The patient can give themselves an additional, but only to a certain degree.
Mm. Yeah, you can get an extra little shot in addition to the regular infusion. Yeah, it's really quite remarkable what pain control we can achieve. The other thing is bone pain is the very most difficult to control. And we do have special beds now that a patient can use. They're very expensive, they're expensive period, like $85 a day. But there are a series of cushions. They look like 10 or 12 pillows lined up. And there's a continuous air circulating through it, which helps, it's good for the skin because it helps evaporate any moisture that develops, and they're just very comfortable because the pressure points are constantly changing. And they can be very helpful for bone pain. But that is the hardest to control.
Would that occur? Would that be caused by leukemia, or would that be
bone pain?
Yeah, or was that just from lying still from?
It's
so
from metastasis. Okay. The cancer. Usually, bone it has spread from somewhere else. It usually doesn't occur primarily in the bone. But, breast cancer, prostate cancer, often spread to the bone. Are other kinds. And anything can, yeah. I should say too, we do give chemotherapy and radiation therapy for pain control too. Particularly, chemotherapy can sometimes, it won't prolong anybody's life after a certain point. It can, for a long time, work well and prolong a life, but When a patient gets in the final stages, it usually doesn't prolong life, but it can help control symptoms. But radiation can be very helpful in controlling pain, bone pain. If it's, they do a CAT scan and find out what areas in the bone are what we call hot spots, that are very painful, and direct the radiation for a series of treatments to that spot, and it can be very effective for pain control. So that is another avenue for pain control.
Do most people normally go along and
have that continually opt and struggle, or do they have to go to a certain point before they so-called give in and just don't want anymore?
They don't want more treatment?
Yeah. I mean, in other words, to me, the quality of life to me is far more important than the length of life. And I have a real problem when you know what the end result is going to be. I'm desperately prolonging this life for not only monetarily, but for the person themselves. It bothers me.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I know I have a special hang-up about it, but I was just curious I'm totally alone out there.
Yeah. No, everybody is so different, and some people come into it and say, I'm going to fight this thing, and I'm going to beat it.
But don't, after and, this fight, eventually you come to this wall.
Yeah.
And
occasionally we'll find people who just are not going to give up.
Well, and there's so many kinds of medications. My husband took 3 or 4 kinds of chemo.
Right.
He had radiation twice.
Mm-hmm.
He was in a program up at Madison, the experimental program, mm-hmm. in addition to what he took at home. And he never had a lot of difficulty with his treatments. One thing, he was always in good spirits. And he did a lot of laughing, and he was going to enjoy life while he lived. But the next person may be very sick from it, and they may feel, like you said, like life is not worth living.
Yeah, and chemo, some people just have worse side effects than others. Yeah. For others, it is not worth it. And I remember talking to another woman, actually she was my age too, but she had teenagers. She had almost died from chemotherapy, but it had helped her. And her symptoms had subsided quite remarkably. But it was a terrible thing that she had gone through, and she just struggled with whether she should get more chemotherapy because she really felt her teenage daughter needed her.
Well, I understand that we had friends who, this was probably 20 years ago. He was down at San Antonio in the medical hospital, down in the Air Force hospital down there, and they gave him he had Hodgkin's disease, and they gave him like 6 weeks to live. And he said he actually saw fellows he felt willed themselves to death.
Mm-hmm.
And he did fight, and at that time he was in experimental programs, and he had more radiation than anybody that had ever had up to the time that they were given it to him. And he did prolong his life to the point of seeing children from grade school through high school and into college.
Mm-hmm.
And he was one of the few, but he had a tremendous attitude. But even there, toward the end, he was breaking bones in bed and this kind of thing. It was a terrible end.
It really depends on the kind of cancer, how well they tolerate the chemotherapy. I would say most people are willing to try chemotherapy. Most people.
I guess I have the feeling most people feel like they have to at least give it an opportunity because it does.
But another thing which has become very clear to me in hospice is patients do decide when they're going to die. Not if they're going to die. They've got the disease, but when. And often some of them can really linger in the very final days, and you don't know why they're alive, but they have some unfinished business, something they haven't resolved. And sometimes you see that that's resolved, and sometimes you don't, and you don't know exactly what's happening. But we've seen cases where there was a rift in the family, and a patient lay semi-comatose for a week, while son and daughter was in the room not really speaking, and there were finally, the son and daughter got together and the patient died. And similar stories have happened often enough that you know. And sometimes the patient needs to be given permission by the family to go to die. And so that we sort of encourage the family to say, you know, tell your loved one that you're all right, you can make it without them, and you will miss them terribly, but you know you can do it, and it's all right if they go. And we've seen patients die very quickly after they've been given that permission. So it is pretty amazing, the power and control that a patient still has. And I think it's important for the patient to know that they have that control, because they've lost so much control over their life.
It amazes me how far we've come with this, from the point where they wouldn't even talk about it or acknowledge the fact that the end is inside, so to speak, and then we go this other way.
That whole question of control, it just brings up another interesting thing, because it goes back to treating the patient as they were as a person, continuing the same kind of system in the family. Because they have lost so much control, you don't want to take away anything you don't have to, that the patient doesn't have to give up, such as, you know, making decisions, doing whatever they can for themselves. That's real important. Because sometimes families just want to suddenly do everything they can for the patient, out of love, basically, but the patient really needs to continue to be who they are as much as they can.
It would be helpful if you could give us some suggestions about the kinds of things that patients really need to keep control of. Food, you mentioned food, when they want to eat, how much they want to eat, and those things. That seems to be
and make the decision if they're going to eat.
Mm-hmm.
Well, how they want to spend their day. Obviously, they've got to make the decisions about their care, what they want. Make the decisions, how they want to spend their day, what they want to do with their time. One advantage, I think, some people might think this is crazy, but I sort of look at a cancer patient. There are many bad things about cancer, obviously. Nobody wants to die. Nobody wants a disease. But we all have to die in some way. And when you have cancer, you do have a chance to write your final chapter. You have a chance to have some control over your growth in the final stages of your life. And that's kind of heavy. And some people may not look at it that way. I kind of think I'd like to have some control and write my final chapter. To share what I want to share with my family and my friends.